Welcome to the Agile Book Club podcast, where we hang out and talk shop with the authors whose ideas are shaping the agile landscape. Here is your host, Paul Klipp.
Hello, kind listeners. This is your host, Paul, and I hope that you've had a chance to read ahead and get a copy of Gil Broz's book, because today we're going to be doing a deep dive into some of the questions that I had about how to actually apply the ideas in this book. And if you've read it as well, you probably have questions of your own. It is my hope that we have some of the same questions and I can get them answered for you today. So let's jump right in to the second half of my interview with Gil Broz and a deep dive into the questions of how to apply the ideas from his latest book, Deliver Better Results, How to Unlock Your Organization's Potential. All right. So in addition to describing these five levels of fitness in which an organization may find themselves at any particular point in time, for each of them, you describe two or three approaches, very, very general approaches, to getting to the next level. And one of the concepts that you introduce early, I think it's in the section about getting from level one to level two, but it applies to most of these concepts, is the idea of the change leaders being committed but not attached. What does that mean?
This is one of my favorites. And when I teach courses, people really latch onto that. I think the concept comes from Landmark Education. I didn't take it myself, but since I've learned it, it's been a game changer for me as well. Let's say you're leading something, a change, a new system design, even a project for that matter. What should you be committed to? Generally, you're committed to reaching the objectives, to creating a healthy environment, high-level things like that. For instance, when I help companies, you know, upgrade their agile ways of working, I'm committed to their success doing that. The attached bit, which we don't want to be, is what exact shape that will take. So if I'm committed to an organization, I am not attached to them succeeding with Scrum and nothing but Scrum, or with Kanban and nothing but Kanban. By the same token, the strategies here, you want to be committed to helping the systems people apply them and make them kind of second nature without being attached to, they're going to end up looking like this or like that. For instance, collaboration, it's a portion of one of the strategies. Collaboration does not mean mob programming. It can mean mob programming for some teams. If everybody wants it, go for it. But it's not like, you know, it's going to be this or nothing else. Or, you know, 10 years ago, it would have been, you know, pairing or nothing else. But instead, we're committed to people acting more collaboratively, which I simply define as, you know, owning results together. And then they figure out how they want to make it happen. It does not have to look like pairing or even sitting together, which we no longer do since the pandemic, or anything else.
I'm going to come back to collaboration, but that's one of the later interventions. But sticking with the level one, level two improvement initiatives, one of the points that you make, which I really liked, is that a common pitfall is that when you're thinking about process changes or when you're thinking about structural changes, organizations tend to focus on changing the structure of the development teams or the processes of the development teams and not changing the structure or the processes of management, which gives the impression that management doesn't have to change in order to succeed at an agile transformation. And so my question for you is, what sort of procedural or structural changes would you expect to see in management levels during this kind of a transformation?
So that, of course, depends on the current level and which of the strategies you are applying. For instance, if you are at level one and you want to go to level two, one of the strategies is to really get your project portfolio under control, which means managing it, you know, strategically and for capacity. This has a lot to do with how management, and management is who owns the portfolio, really, how they carry themselves, how they involve others or not, how they decide what will be done or not be done, what gets parked or just deprioritized or any of that. And one of the recommendations I make there is, you know, you want to have a cross-functional management team manage the portfolio. For some organizations, that is going to be a change. because the portfolio is managed by just maybe one or two people, and they might be called product, they might be called the business, they might be called something else. And then maybe the development is simply on the receiving end of whatever they decided. So this would be an example of really a shift from we manage things in a relatively siloed manner to at least we make high-level strategic decisions more collaboratively. Other things that change at the management level have to do with how we engage with individuals. Maybe we have cycles for this, like the one-on-one. Maybe we have, well, another cycle is like performance evaluation or OKRs. And also how we engage with individuals or teams when stuff blows up. So maybe our habit has been to look for the guilty. And one thing that we want to change is, before we look for the guilty, let's see if we can explain things by how is the system not great? What did the system do via its normal operation to cause what happened? And this is something that, you know, there are several organizations that I'm aware of right now that actually do that. Instead of jumping to the conclusion of, you know, this person, let's say, I don't know, deployed to production and broke the, you know, operational site, what happened in their context in terms of work processes and work management and plans and whatnot to make that possible? Let's close that problem.
Now, it's challenging for humans to behave in the way in which they would have wished to behave while under duress. How does leadership prepare to behave better in the future than they have in the past under crisis?
I love this question. Well, there are several answers. One is you build mechanisms for this. So for instance, many organizations already have some procedure in place when there is a production issue. Maybe the process isn't quite written down, but they have a sequence of steps they go through. You can change that process. So if you change basically the response mechanism, over time it becomes habitual. Now, that usually doesn't do anything for mindset, right? Changing process doesn't usually change mindset. We've learned this from 20-odd years of Agile. But if you accompany this with how do we want to be or act when there are difficult situations? Do we want to be collaborative? Do we want to be trusting? Do we want to be accommodating? Do we want to not look bad? Whatever it is. And you build awareness around this and you implement it through the processes. So I'll give you an example. A client I had a few years ago, one of the first things I did with them is decide what do we want our new values to be? And it took them a lot of time to figure out what they wanted their values to be, but then they figured it out and they said, you know, we really want to be collaborative. We have not been, and it's time we did something about that. We are not learning fast enough. The industry is moving too fast. There were a couple of big players that were disrupting them. We need to be learning fast and we constantly need to be improving our thing. And so this became like the thing, the management mantra, collaborate, learn, improve. And I was there mostly to coach them. And, you know, one of the things a coach does is simply remind people of how they said they wanted to be and kind of help them act that way while they're busy doing other things. And so it was like through months, a couple of years, actually, I was there like once a month. It was working with them on, okay, so you wanted to collaborate, learn, improve. How have you been implementing it this month? What else is coming up where you could be implementing it again? And it became habitual. It started feeling right.
You know, rather than getting into each of the 10 practices, I feel like I saw a small handful of patterns reading through the second half of this book. And I would characterize them in this way. One is a pattern towards increased psychological safety. Another is a pattern towards increased software craftsmanship. Another is a pattern towards increased decentralization of decision making. And so exploring them this way, let's start with psychological safety. This is a tricky one. And I'm going to admit that despite the fact that I've been in this industry for a very, very long time, Okay. Bob Martin's been in it longer, but I've been doing this for over 20 years now. I've never in my career experienced what I would describe as optimal psychological safety or even good psychological safety in an organization. It seems to be very, very rare.
That is probably a fair statement. Yes.
And so, especially in what is frequently a climate of fear, when you have a leader who would like to create psychological safety. One of the points that you make, and many others make it too, is that building psychological safety takes a long time and a great deal of effort. Destroying it is remarkably easy.
Correct.
And all it takes is one person poorly placed, behaving poorly in a single instant to destroy months of hard work. So my question for you is, how does a leader who wants to create psychological safety and embark on a long-term project of doing that ensure that the conditions are in place to avoid undermining and destroying those efforts?
I think one reason safety is a little bit tricky in organizations is that it's localized. Maybe you have one person in middle management, maybe they're, you know, avid readers, or they go to the conferences and they keep hearing about the safety, and then say, you know what? Yeah, we're not great about it. I want us to be different. But then they make changes locally. I know of several teams in several companies where, you know, there is like one, let's say, director or VP, and in their group, people actually don't feel safe. They know they might lose their job to layoffs or to downturns or for like serious blunders, but they know that they're not going to lose their job over, you know, speaking up in the interest of the company or pointing out problems or things like that. But then you look at their colleagues elsewhere, either in the system or elsewhere in the company, maybe in other value delivery systems, and that's not the experience of those other people. And then what happens is that let's call them the individual contributors, although safety is also for managers, the individual contributors, they look at this and they notice the mismatch. And then they realize, oh, my boss, my director, they're great. But when push comes to shove, they will get pushed. And so I don't know if I can trust this much. So maybe it's safety for the little things. My advice, and this I think is borne out by experience in larger companies, including companies that have nothing to do with software development, is you want to go as far up as possible. And at that level, the leaders, if they care enough about safety to make it a thing, it's not a line item someplace, but it's a value, then they need to work with their directs and indirects on applying this across the board. And yes, it will take time, and not everybody will get it the same way. But we also need to be speaking the same language here, because a lot of people have no clue what it is, what safety actually is, and they don't realize the models, they don't realize what builds it, what destroys it. And so you definitely need to at least even train people in that. One thing I noticed when I was working on the book is that the safety we talk about in the Agile community is a bit far-reaching. It's probably more far-reaching than we always need it to be. I took a great interest in Timothy Clark's model of safety with the four levels. And it turned out that those four levels of safety correspond perfectly to the levels of fitness that I was talking about. And so, for instance, if your system is at level one, and again, level one systems are like basically troubled, right? You don't need to build great contributor safety or challenger safety and then make your changes. First off, it's not going to happen. And the other thing is it's more than you need. But what you do need is the first level from his model, which is inclusion safety. People at least need to feel like they belong, at least that. Otherwise, nothing would work. And as you go through the levels, then you expand the safety, which, by the way, goes to one of the other patterns you mentioned, which is craftsmanship. In a lot of organizations, craftsmanship is not practiced because it's not safe to practice it. Because we just need to deliver. There's backlog, there's velocity, there's all sorts of, you know, delivery metrics. That's what they care about. That's what they care about. Craftsmanship, yeah, I would love to do it. Probably not here.
And I imagine that has a lot to do with the fact that the impact of poor craftsmanship tends to be invisible to the people who...
And later. It also comes in late.
Yeah.
On somebody else's watch.
All right. That's psychological safety. Let's talk about collaboration and decentralization of decision-making. Starting with two concepts that you contrast, and I really like this contrast, and that is the difference between a team and a work group, which really made me start thinking how many of the teams that I've seen were really work groups. What's the difference between a team and a work group?
Let's first start by saying that everywhere they have teams. Now, some companies might say, oh, we don't use that term. We have pods. We have squads. It's like, those are not teams. They're better than teams, but not really. So team is when you have people who do in fact have a shared purpose, but the purpose is kind of close enough to them, right? Because when you think about any two random people in an organization have the purpose of making the organization succeed, but that's too far removed from them. In a team, people have a shared purpose that is close enough to them conceptually that they really do care about it. They have each other's back. They pitch in where necessary. And they also think of themselves as a team. That means that the work belongs to all of them. That's why pitching in is, okay, we're a group. On the surface, it might not look very different, which is why a lot of organizations mistake their work groups for teams. But in the work group, essentially, everybody has their own work. In Agile, the classic place to see this is the stand-up. You go to the stand-up and you listen to people giving updates, which are all personal, and everybody talks about what's on their plate, what they have done, and all of that, as opposed to focusing on the work, because the work should belong to the team, but instead it's parceled out. Now, it can be that in some organizations, all you really need are work groups. It's okay. You don't really need the extra capability of teamwork because it's not going to matter much or it's just impossible. I'll give you an example of this way back. Actually, my first, 2 year stint using Agile methods, like 2002 in a scientific environment. So I was managing a team. Again, we called it a team because what else would we call it? And I had five people, but we worked in bioinformatics. Right, so basically the application of data and math to biology. And I had two people on the team with a PhD in biology and very little knowledge of programming. I had programmers on the team with very little biology knowledge. Tried to have some collaboration on occasion, but really, this was not a cohesive team because it was clear where the programming tasks would go and where the more subject matter expertise goes because, yeah, you do need a PhD for that stuff. So that was just the reality. I just had to work with that, and the team was fine with that. But there are many, many situations in product development and solution delivery where you would, in fact, benefit from having a proper team. So calling it that is not enough. You also need to make it possible. You make it possible through how you engage, how you lead, how the work gets broken down, how the work gets described, and a host of other things. Organizations that don't really realize that what they have are work groups instead of teams, they are usually process-oriented and not very people-oriented. That's been my observation.
And the dangerous part here is that they can function because you give a programmer a task and she can execute it. But if a team is really required, then that task would have been executed better if it was done by the team instead of by that programmer.
Right. Now, what's super interesting is to notice that what you said there actually relies on a hidden belief that the team is, in fact, more powerful than a group. And like I mentioned before, there are situations where that's not the case. Although in software development, it tends to be that, yeah, if a team worked on it, it would be better. Now, that does not mean, again, mob programming. It can mean just more people weighing in. It can mean more frequent touch points with each other. It can mean not using GitFlow and instead actually talking to each other, things of that nature.
Listening to each other during the stand-up.
About that. And actually talking to each other and not to the person leading the meeting because they are expecting your status update.
Mm-hmm. All right. And collaboration. I've got to ask this because I can tell from the book that you're passionate about the powers of collaboration.
Oh, yes.
But I can't help thinking also that just last year I talked to the authors of Team Topologies, and they made a rather eloquent case against collaboration in that book, which is that it's the most expensive way of working together and should be reserved for situations in which collaboration is really required. Sometimes we think more collaboration is always better, but it can be very expensive. And I'm wondering whether your ideas about collaboration are in conflict with that attitude towards collaboration that's put forth in the Team Topologies book, or if I'm misunderstanding your position.
So I think my ideas are in fact aligned with what you said here. In fact, in my own book, I say that what the ideal state is for a given team is actually some type of balance between collaboration, cooperation, and solo work. So, you know, you can have solo work, you take a task, you finish it, you don't even need to tell anyone, you've just done it. Cooperation is when we kind of help each other, but we each have our own thing, and collaboration is we own some things together. Absolutely right, collaboration can be expensive. But then the question is, where should you apply it? So you mentioned that, you know, in team topologies, they say it needs to be reserved to special cases. The trouble is knowing which cases those are. And the other thing is, what makes us think it's expensive? Now, on the face of it, having three people do the work of one, yeah, does look more expensive. But then you might say, well, by doing that, what did we prevent? Did we prevent extra testing, fixing, breakage in production, misunderstandings, reinventing the wheel, all sorts of things? Now, all of this stuff is practically unmeasurable, right? And you're only going to get a qualitative idea for it, which in my case, in my world, that's fine. But the thing is this, collaboration doesn't happen spontaneously between any two people. It just doesn't. Certain conditions need to be in place for it to take hold. And the book actually lists all of them, and there's 9 of them, which is also one reason why collaboration is so rare. Because a lot needs to happen before person A and person B will say, yeah, we are going to be collaborating on this one. So if you're a leader of a team or several, and you're thinking, yes, I want my people to be collaborating where it's appropriate, you actually need to make a lot of preparation work, lay the groundwork so that this is even possible. I mean, one of the, I don't know, fallacies that the Agile community has had for 2 decades, and the pandemic put a stop to that, is just put people together in the same space and they'll collaborate. Well, no, they didn't. Yes, they kind of chatted and they made a lot of noise, and occasionally they could, you know, move a chair over and look at something together. So that at least removed a barrier to collaboration, which we put back up with remote work. But it doesn't actually create collaboration kind of out of thin air. And instead, you need, you know, some cultural elements, some teamwork elements, some leadership elements to be in place before this would even become relevant. Now you said that I appear, you know, that I'm big on collaboration. Absolutely. And let me tell you, as a small business owner, it's particularly interesting to look at when I engage with contractors and vendors and like people building my website or my book editor or other people, because in the industry, everybody is used to the handoff, to the contract, to the fixed price, to the tell me what to do and I'll do it. And I come in with a more adaptive and collaborative mindset, and it's hard to make this change. It's really hard to make this change. And all of those experts and specialists, and I hire them for their expertise, they're not always very open to collaboration. They don't even expect it. So that's created a lot of interesting experiences for me and some material for the book.
So which of those 9 preconditions are missing in those relationships?
I think there is a little bit of a trust issue there because they don't know me yet. Some of those experts, like it's my 4th book, right? So I've rehired some of people from before, and then it's much, much easier because the trust is already there. What else could be missing? They think it might be more work for them. Goes back to the expensive bit. And sometimes I say, I am so happy to pay for extra time because I caused it. But what I'm optimizing for here is quality of deliverable. And yes, you know, you're an expert and you do quality work, but I need it to be fit for purpose for me. Hence, I'm willing to spend the time and the money to collaborate with you. And, you know, some of them are good with that. And with some, it's there's more friction. It should be much easier when it's, you know, a bunch of people working for the same company. Should be.
Oh, okay. So what I'm hearing is that collaboration is hard. It's difficult to create an environment for collaboration. There's lots of barriers to collaboration. And so the ideal is to create an environment in which when collaboration is necessary, it happens. But you also have enough psychological safety that people don't collaborate just for the sake of collaborating. Somebody can safely say, I think we're over-engineering this, or I think we're overthinking this.
You know what? I'm thinking yes and no. So on one hand, yes, I want people to not collaborate just for the heck of it. On the other hand, sometimes I actually want them to because it can be more fun. It can be more rewarding. It can be energizing. And then they might also discover that, you know what? We didn't think we were going to collaborate on this, but maybe we should have. Like, I remember a time, somebody on my team, when I was a developer, he made the tiniest of changes. seriously, it was the equivalent of turning a plus to a minus. And he was struggling with the damn thing for an hour, not figuring out why it doesn't work. The guy was actually really good, but it was just a dumb oversight. That was all it is. And at some point, you know, you stare at code long enough, you don't even see what's going on there anymore. So he reached out to me, and I'm talking back screen share days, like 2000 and a bit. He said, hey, can you take a look? And like, I saw it in a minute. Now, what was more expensive here? Having collaborators from the get-go or not? It's unknowable. But one thing we learned from this is, you know, sometimes maybe I can tell that I'm not 100% focused this minute, or maybe I'm having a bit of a moody day and I would really like to have another person there, not just a screen in front of me. Let's work on this together. I want people to feel safe enough to do that, even though in the grand scheme of, you know, bean counting and efficiency, it is not ideal.
All right. Let's talk about decision making, because you also talk a lot about decision making, not only improving decision making, but also decentralization of decision making is my word. You actually describe it in a number of different practices at different levels of fitness, at which the end state is where the people who are capable, people who are best placed to take decisions, do so in an effective way. Now, this strikes me as one of the things that can be a barrier to change from the leadership standpoint, going back to that earlier question about leadership fear, which is that as you push responsibility and accountability and decision making down, that takes a huge weight of responsibility off the shoulders of leaders. What are they to do with all of that excess bandwidth that they're going to get?
Well, that will not happen in a single day, so they probably don't have a lot to worry about. Here's the thing. Decision-making kind of gets decentralized in my model only, you know, late level 3, early level 4. Level 2, we're only just making sure that, you know, every decision even has a home, and it may be top-down. But what we do like at level 4 is we do improve decision-making. We do give people more leeway, more autonomy over outcomes, not just little decisions. That is what the leaders lead. They lead the making it possible for people to make informed decisions, reliable decisions, live with the consequences, improve things as they go along. So the idea is not to make it free-for-all, because also the level of, you know, autonomy that I suggest there is still contextual. In some organizations, you don't want the teams to have too much autonomy because of whatever reason, and that's totally fine if it's made, you know, in a very intentional way. But to the extent that you are, in fact, empowering people and giving them autonomy, make it safe for them to make decisions, including bad ones. Make it safe for them to engage, to take the time to think, to actually look at how those decisions turned out. And doing all of this is really, that is strictly a leadership activity. It's no longer management. You know, I based a lot of the recommendations on what I have seen at some clients, but also what I learned from the industry. There's a reason this stuff happens only at level 4. At the lower levels, the systems are just not ready for it. It's too much, which is another reason why so many agile transformations have bombed, because do everything everywhere all at once, right? And including the autonomy. Hey, we put you together. We call you a team. You're now empowered. Go forth and deliver excellence. Yeah, like we're still ready for it.
Indeed. It takes a lot of context. It takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of psychological safety. It takes a lot of structure and process.
That too, yes.
In order to make good decisions. Talking about higher levels, my last couple of questions are about these higher levels of fitness. And the first is, when I'm looking at these levels of fitness, I'm aware that many of the organizations I've been in have been at level 1, 2, and 3. And from most points of view, from many organizations, level 3 looks pretty darn good, and level 4 is really impressive. How do you avoid the complacency that comes from the satisfaction of improvement? If you get an organization from level 1 to 3, the pressure to say, well, this is just great, pat ourselves on the back and stop here, must be very high.
It is. But here's the thing. One reason I really like this model, and one reason for its evolution in the first place, is this idea that you don't need to transform from troubled to awesome in one go. But instead, it's okay to keep getting better. And if at some point what you got to is good enough, you're not going to get the support of the rest of the organization to go further, or there's just too much going on and you need to worry more about execution than about, you know, system management, that's okay too. So in fact, I think it's wonderful that we can help a system get from, let's say, level 2 to 3. That takes work. And that's so much improvement already. They'll get to 3 to 4 when they're ready for it. Now, some really like this and they want to keep going. So the case study I share in the appendix, how we went from level 1 to 4, that was like that. It wasn't like, okay, we good enough. Bye, Gil. We'll take it from here. No, they actually liked what they were doing. They extended the contract. So just having me around again once every 3 weeks to just kind of see, well, how are things going? What are some of the new hangups? And, you know, what are you trying to change here? How you're dealing with some of the scary new projects? That is what was enough to keep the momentum going.
Now, the description of level 5 is so compelling as a concept. If a group of change leaders decides to go through the multi-year journey of getting their organization to level 5, and they succeed, and everyone agrees on the assessment that we are now in a level 5 organization, what is the risk of complacency? Now that the heavy lifting is over, what do they have to watch out for?
What they have to watch out for, and I do make this point in the book because I've seen it happen enough, is a change at the top. What's happened to several level 5 systems that I'm familiar with, some have been clients, some are not. Also, what I've heard from other people in the industry is because the system is not the entire organization, that's so not the point of the model, right? The point is just to work on, you know, technological value delivery. There are people above it, like a CEO or COO, or powerful stakeholders, and all sorts of other people who over time might change, new people might come in, and they might have different views on how to run things, and they might kind of gut the system. It's happened. Now, is this preventable? Not entirely, because the decision to bring those new people on board is usually done either by the board or by the CEO or, you know, forces outside of the system. One thing that has been known to help is for the system's senior leaders, who now that, again, the heavy lifting is done, to really work on building good bridges with their counterparts across the organization so that there is enough trust, there is enough familiarity, there is constantly giving more and more evidence that, you know, what we've built here really works. So if a new person comes in and has other opinions, they might think about them twice. Because, like, why mess with the good thing? I've seen that work. It, again, it's not a ironclad insurance policy. What can you do?
I imagine also one of the values of having a reasonably simple to deploy assessment is it's easy to create evidence of backsliding when it
Absolutely.
Happens.
This assessment, when I put it together, one of my criteria for it was that a senior leader can do it in 10 minutes. No big surveys, no need to deploy consultants for months, 10 minutes. And in my experience, that has been true. The first time takes longer because it's like, what is this thing? Oh, so it's 20 minutes. But once you know what it's like, it's 10. And I recommend, you know, you do this every few weeks, couple of months, again, 10 minutes. And then you can see if there is some backsliding.
All right. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been fascinating. We've run over an hour now. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you, is there anything that we should have touched on that I didn't?
One thing I think is a bit special about this book is that people do need to work with their colleagues on putting it in place. So one risk I see is that, you know, somebody picks it up, says, okay, good idea, I'll get to it someday. And that's just how it is. But instead, you sort of need a critical mass of interest and engagement and motivation on part of, you know, leaders. And so that's actually why I wrote chapter one the way I did. I wrote it so that if somebody reads this book and says, my boss, this was my use case, if my boss needs to read this, my boss is busy, they're not going to read this, I could tell them, just read chapter one.
And that's the end of my two-part interview with Gil Broza, author of Deliver Better Results, How to Unlock Your Organization's Potential. I hope you found it exciting and interesting and captivating and stimulating and motivating. And if you want to get the book, you'll find a link to get the book in the show notes. Now, this is the point at which I usually tell you which book I'm going to be reviewing next in April, but Maybe I'll just make it an April Fool's joke, because the next episode's going to come out on April 1st, but I'm actually looking at a number of books, and I haven't confirmed the availability of any of the authors yet. And so if you want to know which book we're going to be talking about on April 1st, you're going to have to follow the Agile Book Club on social media. I'll be announcing it on our LinkedIn profile, our Instagram profile, our Facebook profile, and our X profile. And so the links to follow those profiles will be in the show notes. Otherwise, you can just come back on April 1st and be surprised. Thank you so much for listening. Take care.